Welcome to the 11KPW podcast, an update on discrimination by Sean Jones, QC. This talk was given at the 11KPW Employment Law Conference on the 16th of May 2016. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kpw.com.
Thank you and welcome to the graveyard shift. I'll be your grave digger for the next 30 minutes. I'm going to start by doing what barristers love doing most of all, which is disagreeing with colleagues. So far as data protection is concerned, the Bible is rife with references to data protection. In fact, the entire thing kicks off with unauthorised access to data in the Garden of Eden. And while it boggles the mind what fine the ICO would come up with for the Lord Almighty himself, not only did he not secure the data, but he left it dangling in the most delicious fruit imaginable and within arm's reach of the only two people who were capable of taking it. So sorry to have to disagree with my learned friend. But I'm forced by my duty and ego to do so. So discrimination law, what has happened? The answer is a huge amount. So I'm not going to be able to cover everything that's in my handout over the course of the next 30 minutes. But I do have some particular plums to pull out of the pie. One case I'm going to tell you about has the single best job title Earth has ever seen. As soon as you see it, you will feel desperately jealous that your life has not taken you down that path. I'm not going to tell you what it is just yet. I'm going to save that. That will come up in about 20 minutes' time. So if sleep was otherwise going to overcome you, please at least stay awake for that. But I'm going to start by asking the difficult question, which is, why is discrimination law so hard? It should be really easy. So my heart was pretty much broken a couple of weeks ago. My 10-year-old daughter took me to one side and said, "Dad, what kind of jobs can girls do?" And I thought how incredibly sad it was that, in discrimination law as I am, I'd brought up my daughter and she's still asking questions like that. Why isn't it obvious that girls can do all jobs? As I put it to her, only then to receive a clip round the ear from my wife, what kind of jobs require a penis? On the face of it, very few. Although last time I asked this question at a talk, someone came back with penis model, which is fair enough. Told me rather more about the person who gave me the answer than perhaps he had realised. But there you go. I mean, what sorts of jobs require your skin to be a particular colour or, impose any demand on you in terms of the sort of person you find sexually attractive? I mean, the point about discrimination law, the reason why it is at essence simple and why it should be simple is because discrimination is both unfair. I think everyone now recognises that, at least as a matter of intellectual agreement, but it's also ridiculously stupid. What an amazingly stupid way to take business decisions, taking into account things that plainly have no sensible relevance to your business. And one weeps at the thought, all of the talent that has been thrown away over the course of the years. So direct discrimination is the one we're all familiar with, and I'm going to come in a moment to talk about who an appropriate comparator is for the purposes of a direct discrimination claim. But even that, apparently incredibly simple concept, has been complicated to such an extent that you can read 25 pages of appellate decision in which they carefully and philosophically distinguish between motive and motivation. And you think, well, my brain is now boiling in my head. Why is that necessary for something that should be a relatively straightforward concept? And I heard a great speech by another barrister from another set. I'm going to get kicked by my head of chambers for saying such thing. David Stevenson, who said, the truth is this, that we take discrimination very seriously now. And the consequence of that is that courts are, possibly in the reverse of the policy intended, reluctant to make a finding of discrimination because of the consequences for it. That it begins to be something, it becomes a hunt for not race discrimination or sex discrimination, but sexism or racism. They're looking for, at a sub-unconscious level, sufficient villainy to pin on the employer the consequences of a finding, and that distorts the approach. And I think we're going to see a bit of that over the course of the next few minutes. Indirect discrimination, which we're going to be spending quite a bit of time on, is something which on its face is much more complicated, but meets a fairly straightforward and unacknowledged public need, which is this. We have to bear in mind that the society in which we live, the way in which we organise ourselves socially and economically, is the product of everything we've been doing for centuries back. So we've had centuries of essentially non-stop direct discrimination decisions. So you don't have to go very far back beyond living memory before it was obvious that women shouldn't have the vote, and obvious that if you were white and British, you'd won life's lottery, and all the other sort of astonishing stuff that one can read on this subject. And that has an effect beyond the individual consequences of the decision. What I'm going to suggest to you is it warps society, and it warps the way we organise ourselves, so that without necessarily even realising it, and importantly, without it being obvious, it creates barriers and disadvantages. And the great power of indirect discrimination as a remedy is it attacking that. It can on its face say, here is a real disadvantage that we can see. It is disadvantaging groups in the first instance, and individuals specifically, because of their protected characteristic. Something can now be done to put that right. And the danger is that in our approach to indirect discrimination, we do something similar to what we do in direct discrimination and go looking for racism, sexism, etc., and lose the remedial power of indirect discrimination. And I make that rather highfalutin point because I think this year that drift has become a canter away from a correct approach to indirect discrimination. And we're going to see in relation to two cases, both now joined and on their way to the Supreme Court, just how far the appeal courts have been prepared to go, to my mind, in neutering indirect discrimination and protection. So let's start with a specific case. Doncor, which is a case on direct discrimination and comparators, it arises in a traditionally vexed area, termination payments and age discrimination. So one often finds that the older you are, the more money you get on termination. And not simply because it reflects how long you've been in service, but many termination schemes take account of what is a plain statistical fact, which is that the older you are on the termination of your employment, the lower your chances of getting another job. So many schemes factor that in and provide older employees with more by way of pay or benefits on termination than you would get as a younger employee. A couple of years ago, in a case called Lockwood, they looked at this head on. Peter Clark in the AT had been faced with a case in which someone who was under 35 was complaining that had they been older than that, they'd have got an awful lot more on termination of employment. And the response of the employer was to say, but we have looked at statistics, and statistics establish that if you lose your job when you're older than 35, your chances of getting another job are substantially reduced. And we want to take that, as a matter of fairness, into account in structuring our termination payment regime. And what Peter Clark had to say was that gets built as a factor into the comparison. So you, under 35-year-old, can't compare yourself with someone who is over 35 because your circumstances are materially different. You're at an age at which you're probably going to be able to get another job. Your older colleagues are not. They're at an age at which they're going to find it much harder. And the Court of Appeal said that's completely the wrong approach. You should leave this out of the comparison, because what you're really doing is working age back in to the comparison exercise. Because the reason why the statistics establish it's harder to get another job is age. So if you make that a distinguishing characteristic, you're really using age as a material distinction, and you're not allowed to do that for the purposes of direct discrimination comparison. But they said objectively justified in the circumstances. So Doncor is a case which follows Lockwood. It's a peculiarly strong on its facts. There's a reorganisation. They're reducing the number of regional managers. You're dealing with quite senior staff, in fact, regional directors, if I remember rightly. And there were two members of staff facing redundancy who were older than 50. And the effect of that was that they were potentially entitled to early retirement, only available to you if you're over 50. And the effect of that was that if they both got early retirement, their payments would take up £1.25 million out of a total budget of £1.4 million for the exercise. So those two individuals were going to, between them, effectively suck all of the available redundancy costs out of the exercise. So the employer refers their applications off, and ultimately, simplifying somewhat, they weren't entitled to apply for the voluntary redundancy that might have resulted in their taking early retirement. And they made effectively the sort of reverse Lockwood argument. They say, well, we've been excluded from entitlement, and the reason we've been excluded from entitlement is that we cost too much. And Jenny Eady in the AT said, yeah, but the reason why you cost too much is because you're entitled to early retirement, And the reason why you're entitled to early retirement is because of how old you are. So this is really age again. It's on its face not age, but this is an age factor. So we exclude that from the comparison. And we just say if you're discriminating against someone because they're entitled to early retirement, you're in practice discriminating against them on grounds of age. So that's this slide. And each factor that the employer came up with imaginatively was batted away on the basis that it was effectively inseparable from age. It was a consequence of an age difference. So here is the AT following the Court of Appeal, all nice and clear, until you turn to the last page of the slides or the handout, and you'll find a reference to a case called O and Biophilippe, which is a decision of the European Court of Justice. And that concerned a French law. And the French law said, if you are employed under a fixed-term contract and that fixed-term contract comes to an end, you are entitled as a matter of law to a termination payment. Open brackets, unless you're a student doing vacation work, in which case, tough luck, sonny. Close brackets. So students doing vacation work excluded from entitlement. This was a claim brought by, and of course it goes all the way to the European Court of Justice, a student who did 4 days of vacation work. I said, I'm entitled to a termination payment, however tiny, and by God, yes, I'll take it all the way to the highest court in Europe to decide the issue. So what approach did the ECJ take? Well, they say there's a purpose behind this legislation, and the purpose is to deal with the threat to job security of those employed on fixed-term contracts. And if you're a student, you're not subject to that threat to job security. You just go back to your university course. So you're in a materially different situation to people who are not students, who we accept are in general older than you are, because they have job security issues which you don't, which sounds remarkably like what was run in Lockwood. And what the European Court of Justice says is, well, this is a comparison issue. You can't properly, as a student, compare yourself with older non-student employees employed on fixed terms because their job insecurity is greater and materially different to yours. So we've got a pretty clear approach as a matter of UK law now, but so far as the ECJ is concerned, they seem to have taken a rather different approach, which means, excitingly from us, an inconsistency and much longer opinions than might otherwise have been delivered on relatively straightforward cases. So good news all round. On to something rather more complicated, indirect discrimination. Here is the statutory test on the slide. You're looking for provision, criterion, or practice. You're looking for one which applies or would apply across a group which will include both those with and without the relevant protected characteristic. It needs to be a PCP which puts those with whom the claimant shares a protected characteristic at what's known as a particular disadvantage. And then that individual claimant must also be subject to the same disadvantage. And there is at the end in D an objective justification defence. Now again, the European Court of Justice has had something to say recently about indirect discrimination. A case concerned with a Bulgarian electricity company. They, in an almost refreshingly, straightforwardly bigoted way, had decided that you could not trust Roma with electricity meters, that they would be up to no good. So that if they were going to supply electricity to your premises, you could have a meter and you could read the meter, unless you lived in a predominantly Roma area, in which case it had to be protected from you. And the way in which they decided to protect it was with a phenomenally complicated technical response, which was to put it at the top of a 7-metre-tall concrete pillar. And if you bear in mind, 7 metres would take you beyond this ceiling from floor level. That worked. It was a surprisingly effective response, because unless you were skilled at mountaineering or had a very long ladder indeed, there was no way you were going to get access to the meter. But it also meant there was no way of working out how much electricity you were using. So a claim was brought by someone who was not Roma, but who lived in such an area, and as a result, in a completely non-discriminatory way, also had her meter at the top of a 7-metre pole. So what attitude was the European Court of Justice going to take to this? Well, the European Court of Justice was not happy with this practice, And the first thing it said, logically enough from our point of view, was this was an instance of associative direct discrimination. So that the non-Roma business owner was being discriminated against because of the protected characteristic of those who lived around her. So far, so straightforward. And they dealt with a specific interest, a specific aspect of Bulgarian discrimination law. It said it's not just, in effect, any less favourable treatment that will do. Anything that might be reasonably thought to be a detriment will do. The anti-discrimination legislation is really only engaged in circumstances where a right or a legitimate interest is prejudiced, and the ECJ says, no, forget all about that. You don't have to show that at all. That would be an unacceptable limitation or restriction on the scope of the legislation, which means that the ECJ effectively says, just to reassure you, that the European approach to direct discrimination is pretty much the UK approach to direct discrimination. So nothing there to upset us until we get to indirect discrimination. Now, the first thing they said was, well, of course, you could always bring an associative indirect discrimination claim. Hands up if you knew that you could bring an associative indirect discrimination claim. I have for weeks been pretending I did know because I thought it was just me who didn't know about it, but I'm pleased to be in this company. They have decided, well, of course, you can have an associative indirect discrimination claim. You can look at PCP impact on a group which does not include you, defined by reference to a particular protected characteristic. They had something to say about the directive requirement that a PCP should be apparently neutral. You can ignore that for present purposes because we don't have that in our act. We just talk about applying a PCP to people who do and do not share the particular protected characteristic. They did solve one particular mystery, which is what on earth does particular disadvantage means? That is a phrase which is used in Section 19, and we have often wondered what it means. Could it, for instance, mean more than just a merely trivial disadvantage? Is it telling you something about how big a disadvantage is required before indirect discrimination could be said to have occurred? And the European Court of Justice says no, it's got nothing to do with how serious the disadvantage is. You don't require, to quote them, a serious, obvious, or particularly significant case of inequality. All you require is that the disadvantage should be particular to the people with that protected characteristic. So it's who's affected and not how badly they're affected that particular disadvantage is defining, which I think gives us an insight also into one weirdness in the Equality Act, which is, of course, Section 19, indirect discrimination, requires a PCP to create a particular disadvantage. But when you're in the area of disability discrimination and you're looking at the duty to make reasonable adjustments, again, it's all about PCPs, but they have to create a substantial disadvantage. And you may well have scratched your head and said, well, what's the difference between particular and substantial? Well, substantial must be about how great a disadvantage we're talking about. So it means it now appears, as a result of the ECJ decision, something materially different to particular disadvantage. It isn't just an infelicity in the drafting of the Act. So there we go, associative indirect discrimination. We now know what particular disadvantage means. How's that affect the UK legislation? Well, a couple of points. Firstly, you can bring, of course, an associative direct discrimination action under Section 13 of the Equality Act, on the basis, we were told in the explanatory notes, etc., that the word because that appears in Section 13, less favourable treatment because of a particular protected characteristic, is broad enough to cover associative discrimination. But the word because does not appear in Section 19. Instead, what's required, as you'll have seen, is the group disadvantage and the individual disadvantage. Nothing about because. So we're going to have to, I think, to interpret Section 19 to be a little broader than we might have anticipated that it was going to be. But I don't see that as the sort of challenge that the courts and tribunals are going to be incapable of rising to. So far, so good then. We should be able to deal with associative indirect discrimination. But it does raise an interesting point that we're going to come to immediately, which is this. If you can bring an indirect discrimination claim, suffering a disadvantage in circumstances where you yourself do not have the protected characteristic, it can't be part of the test, if associative indirect discrimination can work, it can't be part of the Section 19 test that you personally must be suffering the disadvantage because you personally have the protected characteristic. Otherwise, associative discrimination would be impossible. Which brings us to this, ESOP. ESOP is a case about a core skills assessment. It's an exam that civil servants must sit. It's a general exam. It's not related to a specific job. You take it. If you pass it, you can move on up the tree and apply for other jobs by way of promotion. If you don't pass it, you can't. It is pretty clear on its face that the exam represents a PCP. No one argued seriously to the contrary in the case. But it appeared to have on its face an adverse and disparate impact on two groups, those who were older and those who were a member of BME ethnic minorities. So both of those groups performed worse in the examination to when compared to white or majority ethnic employee groups or civil servant groups. So there you have it, you've got a PCP. On the face of it, the statistics suggest that there is a disadvantage. And each of the claimants were people who had suffered, they said, that same disadvantage because they had failed the exam. So they brought claims for indirect discrimination. And they had a fantastic piece of statistical evidence. And the statistical evidence said this, that there was in both cases, whether you were dealing with age or race, a 0.1% chance that this disparity in performance arose by accident or by chance. So, you know, 0.1% chance that this was down to mere misfortune. And it wasn't the CSA itself that was somehow systematically discriminating against those with that those particular protected characteristics. So about as strong a case as you can imagine. So why don't they immediately romp to victory? Well, the argument that was run on behalf of the respondent was this. It's not enough to show that, as a matter of fact, there is a disparity at group stage. It's not enough to show that if the disadvantage is failing the exam, that the claimants have also failed. And the reason for that is implicit in the test, although it was accepted, it's not there explicitly on the face of the legislation, is a requirement to show the reason for the disadvantages. Not least because it has said, how can you demonstrate that the individual is subject to the same disadvantage unless you know why these disadvantages have arisen? It should be clear about this. What the Court of Appeal was worried about is a thing called coattailing. So they would say, well, imagine, for instance, that the exam is particularly hard for, let's say, people from Essex, and I appreciate that that's not yet a protected characteristic, but I'm going to campaign to the death until it is. You might say Essex people just find it incredibly difficult to answer these questions. But I'm an Essex person, I take the exam and I fail, but the reason for that is I turn up an hour and a half late for the exam. Have I suffered the same disadvantage? If the disadvantage is simply failing the exam, I have failed the exam. And, you know, my people, the Essex people, are systematically disadvantaged, so shouldn't I win? Well, the Court of Appeal thought that was such a terrifying danger that the only way to deal with it was effectively to require proof that there was a causal connection between the protected characteristic and the group disadvantage, and between the protected characteristic and the individual disadvantage. Now, this is where you bump into a bit of a problem, which is this. No one knew why the CSA was producing this disadvantage. No one could explain why these questions posed in this way in the particular examination environment had that effect. All they could show was that it was having that effect. So if you asked for an explanation, if you asked for the reason to be demonstrated, how was that going to work? Well, the Court of Appeal says we definitely require a reason to be demonstrated at both stages. There is a reason why question, is how they put it. But then they mysteriously let the claimants off the hook at the group stage and say, but the statistics prove it. And you think, well, that just proves there's a disparity, and it proves it's not down to chance, but it doesn't tell you why it's happening. The Court of Appeal says, well, that will do. But what about the individual? Can they then prove that it's the same reason? Well, the Court of Appeal seems to anticipate it's going to be harder for them, but they're given some hope. They're told that although they can't rely on the same statistics to establish that they personally were subject to the same disadvantage, what they can do is use it to reverse the burden. So they can say to the employer, all right, the disadvantage is for the group is that they are more likely to fail. The disadvantage for me is that I have failed. I say it's the same cause. I can't tell you what it is. I'm just telling you it's the same. And it's up now to the employer to prove that it isn't. So last minute goal in the 93rd minute for the claimants, that it becomes a little easier to deal with what would otherwise have been an impossible situation. And you can see the politics of the decision. Unless they took that step, a whole swathe of indirect discrimination protection was going to vanish with a pop. But it's off to the Supreme Court for further consideration. And the argument being run is there isn't a reason why question to be answered. You just apply the act as it appears on its face. If you can show the disparity, if the disadvantage technically is the same, in this case, failing the exam, that will do. Now, I want you to take out your tiny violins and think of counsel in Naeem in the Ministry of Justice, who was, by coincidence, me. And I had put in a skeleton argument to the Court of Appeal, that being the first point at which I'd been instructed in the case, which relied entirely on the decision ESOP in the EAT, which the Court of Appeal reversed and kicked around the room. So when I stood up to address the Court of Appeal, they said, this is an ESOP case, isn't it? And I said, no. And they said, well, you do say it is in your skeleton. I said, I know. And now I'm going to say it's not an ESOP case. And let me explain to you why. So let me give you the facts. And I'm going to try and use that to paper over the cracks in what I had to say. My client, Mr. Naeem, is an imam. And he is specifically an imam who works in the prison service. Until 2002, which I suspect, not entirely by coincidence, but you may take a different view, just before it became unlawful to discriminate on grounds of religious belief, the Home Office's policy was that they only employed Christian chaplains to work in the prison service. Now, that's not to say that there weren't imams working there. Their line was more subtle than that. You could come and work in the prison service, ministering to Muslims if you were an imam, but they wouldn't employ you to do it. They would simply engage you on what they called a sessional basis, effectively a form of self-employment. So that was their policy until 2002, and I was stuck with a particularly unhelpful finding of fact, which was that the reason they had that policy in place was not an instance of arch, although at that point lawful discrimination on grounds of religious belief, but that there was no need to employ them directly. Anyone who wasn't Christian directly. They don't explain why it was necessary to employ Christians, and perhaps they just get more upset unless they are in a direct employment relationship. But there was a difference, apparently, of necessity between those two groups. So come 2002, they abolished the policy. You can now get a job as an imam, and in 2004, finally a vacancy opens up for Mr. Naeem, and he gets the job. And by that point, he has about 4 years of experience doing the job, which is good news for him, because there's also a concession that you only need 6 years of experience to know everything there is to know about the job. That's it. You're at peak experience. But the pay system was one which allowed you an opportunity to go up each year following an assessment of your performance. So the longer you were employed, the higher your pay was likely to be. And although it was justified on the basis that that represented your increasing experience, and although it had been said that 6 years took you to the very top of the mountain, this scheme was at one point 18 years long. So there was just effectively no justifying how long it was. And the government was in the course of trying to bring it back within sensible bounds, but had not yet managed to do so. He was given no credit for his 4 years of experience. He had to start at the bottom of the ladder and climb along with everyone else. So the issue was interesting in the EAT. Mr. Recorder Luber said, you've come along with this case. You have said, if I look statistically at the distribution of pay, what I find is lots of Christians at the top, because they've been able to be employed pretty much forever, and all the Muslims and other non-Christian chaplains clustered at the bottom. He said, well, that suggests a certain disparity. And you might think, well done, so it does. But he said, but that would be to allow you to perform an inappropriate comparison. Your comparison group, the pool we should look at, is those appointed after 2002. And if we do that, you must lose, because everyone progresses up the ladder at the same rate. And we said, yes, and therefore it's not testing the proposition, because the proposition is this. And I'm going to spank this point for a minute, because it's the closest I got to winning any point in the Court of Appeal. If you're going to use indirect discrimination effectively to challenge what one might call structural discrimination, you can't pull a particular PCP out and stare at it in the abstract. You have to ask yourself the question, how is it interacting with everything else to produce the effects that it produces? You've got to judge it in context. And I count that as a win, because Lord Justice Underhill said, I quote, "I don't entirely disagree with that submission." One for the CV. And he went on to say, yes, and in fact, your pay structure, judged in that context, does have a disparate adverse effect against Muslims. So I thought, great, well, we've won then. And indeed, my opponent, Tom Linden, turned to me and said, "You've won then." I said, "We have." And it's the same individual disadvantage too. But then they said, "We're going to retire without hearing the rest of what you had to say," which is never a good sign. And then they came out and said, "You lose, but we're not going to tell you why." A few weeks passed, and out came this decision. So, and it's a subtle one, so it's going to take some thinking about. Lord Justice Underhill says, yes, there is a PCP. Yes, it causes a disparate adverse effect on the group. The group, in this case, being Muslims who share your protected characteristic, O claimant. But we think the phrase "putting at a disadvantage" has a causal element in it. And we say, "We agree, you've just found that it causes that." And he says, "Ah, but we're entitled to go beyond that and ask what the material cause is." And you think, are you? Where's that come from? And what's it mean? And what it means is what he thinks the real cause is. And he thinks the real cause is the policy. In fact, not even the policy, but the reason the policy was introduced, which was, he says, a non-discriminatory reason. So you lose. So a clear example, I think, of what I was describing earlier, which is taking the statutory test, but running away from its implications as hard as you can, looking for effectively, in this case, a sort of racist motive. You're looking for a discriminatory underpinning motive. And it goes well beyond anything which has thus far been said about causation. And for that reason, it's going to the Supreme Court with ESOP. And the application for permission was unopposed by the respondents to give them credit. So we're hoping the Supreme Court will sort this out, by which, of course, we mean in any discrimination case, we hope Lady Hale's going to be delivering the leading judgment. So very quickly through just two more points before we get to general questions, going past the duller cases. NAZIA we have to look at because this is the greatest job title ever. Lifestyle Risk Management Services Implementation Manager. I bet you feel you wasted your time in school now, didn't you? Because you are not a Lifestyle Risk Management Services Implementation Manager, but sadly, neither is Miss NAZIA anymore. Because they decided almost sacrilegiously that there was no need for a Lifestyle Risk Management Services Implementation Manager and made her redundant, which I think you'll agree is an outrage. The facts are unspeakably complicated, and I won't bother you with them, but it did result in some specific guidance on Section 15 cases, discrimination arising, that should say more accurately, from something arising in consequence of disability. It's the most beautiful test in the Equality Act. And why is that the case? Because it's got double causation in it. There are two causation tests in a single sentence. It's like having double eggs and bacon at breakfast. So the first point is, does what has happened relate to something which arises in consequence of the disability? So that something, did the something, as the guidance suggests, more than trivially influence the reason for action? So that's the standard Section 13 causation test. It's enough that it's a substantive cause. And then the second causal question is thought to be a bit more open textured. You just ask very broadly, is the something something which arises in consequence of the disability? That can be something which has a huge chain between it and the disability, but the longer the chain gets, the harder it becomes to prove. It's a slightly, subtly different causal test, but two causal tests in a single sentence of legislation. And this guidance given by the new president of the EAT, Ingrid Simler, I have simplified from her bullet points. So I hope I've captured the essence of it. But there's no doubt that going forward, this will be where you start when looking at Section 15 cases. And then finally, I want to deal with Griffiths, which is a reasonable adjustment case. And I want to deal with it because it raises an issue with which I guarantee you are all familiar, which is the interaction between disability discrimination protection and absence procedures and disability-related sickness, which has been causing heads to explode for many years now. So, relatively straightforward case. There was an absent management procedure. It kicked off once there were 8 days of absence. The claimant had way more than that. She had 62 days of absence. And once that trigger point was reached, the employer had a choice. There was a discretion in the management procedure to allow those who were absent because of a disability a certain degree of grace, and that was allowed in this case, but ultimately what they did was give her a warning. And two specific reasonable adjustments were asked for. Get rid of the warning, please, and in future, move the trigger point back to a surprisingly specific 20 days. So the 20-day extension of the trigger point was what was being sought. Were these adjustments reasonable? Ultimately, the Court of Appeal says no, but it's their journey there which is interesting. So the respondents argued pretty much everything that could be argued. The first thing they said was there was a difficulty with the PCP. There was one, but they said the PCP is the absence management procedure, and that's in fact how it had been run by the claimant. And they said it cannot place you at a substantial disadvantage, really for two reasons. One, because there is a specific discretion in it to apply it differently in disability cases, but also because we apply it to everyone, to which Lord Justice Elias, tapping his pen, replied rather testily, well, duh, of course, that's the point about indirect discrimination. You know, you apply the same thing to everyone, but it affects some of them worse than it affects others. So he said this is the properly analysed reasonable adjustment, which seems to me to be an exotic form of indirect discrimination, essentially requires you to look through the fact that it applies to everyone and ask, is it disadvantaging the claimant? Is it subjecting them to a substantial disadvantage? And it is. And if the claimant had been smarter than she was, what she should have argued is not that the procedure was the PCP, but that inherent in the procedure was a requirement for regular attendance. And that disadvantages people who are disabled because they're more likely to be absent. So then a rather more subtle argument, which said, this is not the sort of step that the Act has in mind. So when you're talking about reasonable adjustments, you have to take steps. What steps are we talking about? Well, they said, by asking us to amend the procedure so as to allow you greater leeway to be absent, you're departing from the underlying policy of the Act, because the policy of the Act is to get you to work. So we shouldn't be required to make reasonable adjustments that make it easier for you to be away from work. That's the opposite of the policy underpinning the Act. Now, I tried a variation of that argument once in the AT, where I argued in relation to a man with balance difficulties who twice a week would fall down the rickety staircase into the basement in which he worked. I was arguing on the side of evil on this occasion, that it was completely ridiculous to suggest that it was a reasonable adjustment to spend the, I kid you not, £10 buying the banister, or use the hour that it was going to require to install it to alleviate this potentially fatal problem for him, because he'd so badly injured himself that he wasn't at work anymore, so it wasn't subjecting him to a substantial disadvantage. And I will, of course, go to hell for arguing that in front of the AT, albeit it's not going to surprise you that it was appallingly unsuccessful. And a variation of this argument is brought up in this case, and Lord Justice Elias says this. You say it's all about allowing them to be absent, but what you're actually doing is dismissing people for being absent. And what is going to help them come to work more than avoiding not being in work anymore because they've been sacked? So that's the essential point here. If you're making it easier to get rid of them, you're making it harder for them to come back to work ultimately. So this is the kind of step we have in mind, although he does say there will be some which don't fall within that definition. And he has in particular O'Hanlon in mind, and he says paying people at full rates of pay forever despite their absence probably isn't the kind of thing that the Act has in mind. But ultimately, he says these aren't reasonable adjustments. And he says that for technical reasons relating to the facts, which I needn't bother you with in detail. But in essence, and of some importance in relation to the requirement to move the trigger point back, he says this, that you have been too specific in what you've asked for. By saying it should be another 20 days, that's not something that could be adopted as a general policy. It ought to depend on the circumstances. And in essence, if what you'd said is you should amend the policy so that you make the trigger point is such trigger point as is reasonable in the particular circumstances, I might have listened a bit more patiently to what you had to say. So they got incredibly close, made real progress in terms of our understanding of the principles, but ultimately Mrs. Griffiths failed at the final hurdle.